human destiny. The invention of farming around 10,000 years ago multiplied the availability of calories from cultivated plants and domesticated animals, freed a portion of the population from the demands of hunting and gathering, and eventually gave them the luxury of writing, thinking, and accumulating their ideas. Around 500 BCE, in what the philosopher Carl Jaspers called the Axial Age, several widely separated cultures pivoted from systems of ritual and sacrifice that merely warded off misfortune to systems of philosophical and religious belief that promoted selflessness and promised spiritual transcendence. Taoism and Confucianism in China, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism in India, Zoroastrianism in Persia, Second Temple Judaism in Judea, and classical Greek philosophy and drama emerged within a few centuries of one another. Confucius, Buddha, Pythagoras, Aeschylus, and the last of the Hebrew prophets walked the earth at the same time. Recently, an interdisciplinary team of scholars identified a common cause. It was not an aura of spirituality that descended on the planet, but something more prosaic. Energy capture. The Axial Age was when agricultural and economic advances provided a burst of energy, upwards of 20,000 calories per person per day in food, fodder, fuel, and raw materials. This surge allowed the civilizations to afford larger cities, a scholarly and priestly class, and a reorientation of their priorities from short-term survival to long-term harmony. As Bertolt Brecht put it millennia later, grub first, then ethics. When the Industrial Revolution released a gusher of usable energy from coal, oil, and falling water, it launched a great escape from poverty, disease, hunger, illiteracy, and premature death, first in the West, and increasingly in the rest of the world, as we shall hear in chapters 5 through 8. And the next leap in human welfare, the end of extreme poverty and spread of abundance with all its moral benefits, will depend on technological advances that provide energy at an acceptable economic and environmental cost to the entire world. Chapter 10. Intro, Evo, Info. These concepts define the narrative of human progress, the tragedy we were born into, and our means for eking out a better existence. The first piece of wisdom they offer is that misfortune may be no one's fault. A major breakthrough of the scientific revolution, perhaps its biggest breakthrough, was to refute the intuition that the universe is saturated with purpose. In this primitive but ubiquitous understanding, everything happens for a reason. So when bad things happen, accidents, disease, famine, poverty, some agent must have wanted them to happen. If a person can be fingered for the misfortune, he can be punished or squeezed for damages. If no individual can be singled out, one might blame the nearest ethnic or religious minority, who can be lynched or massacred in a pogrom. If no mortal can plausibly be indicted, one might cast about for witches who may be burned or drowned. Failing that, one points to sadistic gods, who cannot be punished but can be placated with prayers and sacrifices. And then there are disembodied forces like karma, fate, spiritual messages, cosmic justice, and other guarantors of the intuition that everything happens for a reason. Galileo, Newton, and Laplace replaced this cosmic morality play with a clockwork universe in which events are caused by conditions in the present, not goals for the future. People have goals, of course, but projecting goals onto the workings of nature is an illusion. Things can happen without anyone taking into account their effects on human happiness. This insight of the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment was deepened by the discovery of entropy. Not only does the universe not care about our desires, but in the natural course of events it will appear to thwart them, because there are so many more ways for things to go wrong than for them to go right. Houses burn down, ships sink, battles are lost for want of a horseshoe nail, Awareness of the indifference of the universe was deepened still further by an understanding of evolution. Predators, parasites, and pathogens are constantly trying to eat us, and pests and spoilage organisms try to eat our stuff. It may make us miserable, but that's not their problem. Poverty, too, needs no explanation. In a world governed by entropy and evolution, it is the default state of humankind. Matter does not arrange itself into shelter or clothing, and living things do everything they can to avoid becoming our food. As Adam Smith pointed out, what needs to be explained is wealth. Yet even today, when few people believe that accidents or diseases have perpetrators, discussions of poverty consist mostly of arguments about whom to blame for it. None of this is to say that the natural world is free of malevolence. On the contrary, evolution guarantees there will be plenty of it. Natural selection consists of competition among genes to be represented in the next generation, and the organisms we see today are descendants of those that edged out their rivals in contests for mates, food, and dominance. This does not mean that all creatures are always rapacious. Modern evolutionary theory explains how selfish genes can give rise to unselfish organisms. But the generosity is measured. Unlike the cells in a body or the individuals in a colonial organism, humans are genetically unique, each having accumulated and recombined a different set of mutations that arose over generations of entropy-prone replication in their lineage. Genetic individuality gives us our different tastes and needs, and it also sets the stage for strife. Families, couples, friends, allies, and societies seethe with partial conflicts of interest, which are played out in tension, arguments, and sometimes violence. Another implication of the law of entropy is that a complex system like an organism can easily be disabled, because its functioning depends on so many improbable conditions being satisfied at once. A rock against the head, a hand around the neck, a well-aimed poisoned arrow, and the competition is neutralized. More tempting still to a language using organism, a threat of violence may be used to coerce a rival, opening the door to oppression and exploitation. Evolution left us with another burden. Our cognitive, emotional, and moral faculties are adapted to individual survival and reproduction in an archaic environment, not to universal thriving in a modern one. To appreciate this burden, one doesn't have to believe that we are cavemen out of time, only that evolution, with its speed limit measured in generations, could not possibly have adapted our brains to modern technology and institutions. Humans today rely on cognitive faculties that worked well enough in traditional societies, but which we now see are infested with bugs. People are by nature illiterate and innumerate, quantifying the world by one, two, many, and by rough guesstimates. They understand physical things as having hidden essences that obey the laws of sympathetic magic or voodoo, rather than physics and biology. Objects can reach across time and space to affect things that resemble them, or that had been in contact with them in the past. Remember the beliefs of pre-scientific revolution Englishmen. They think that words and thoughts can impinge on the physical world in prayers and curses. They underestimate the prevalence of coincidence. They generalize from paltry samples, namely their own experience, and they reason by stereotype, projecting the typical traits of a group onto any individual that belongs to it. They infer causation from correlation. They think holistically, in black and white, and physically, treating abstract networks as concrete stuff. They are not so much intuitive scientists as intuitive lawyers and politicians, marshaling evidence that confirms their convictions while dismissing evidence that contradicts them. They overestimate their own knowledge, understanding, rectitude, competence, and luck. The human moral sense can also work at cross purposes to our well-being. People demonize those they disagree with, attributing differences of opinion to stupidity and dishonesty. For every misfortune, they seek a scapegoat. They see morality as a source of grounds for condemning rivals and mobilizing indignation against them. The grounds for condemnation may consist in the defendants having harmed others, but they also may consist in their having flouted custom, questioned authority, undermined tribal solidarity, or engaged in unclean sexual or dietary practices. People see violence as moral, not immoral. Across the world and throughout history, more people have been murdered to mete out justice than to satisfy greed. But we're not all bad. Human cognition comes with two features that give it the means to transcend its limitations. The first is abstraction. People can co-opt their concept of an object at a place and use it to conceptualize an entity in a circumstance, as when we take the pattern of a thought like, "The deer ran from the pond to the hill," and apply it to, "The child went from sick to well." They can co-opt the concept of an agent exerting physical force and use it to conceptualize other kinds of causation, as when we extend the image in, "She forced the door to open," to, "She forced Lisa to join her," or, "She forced herself to be polite." These formulas give people the means to think about a variable with a value, and about a cause and its effect. Just the conceptual machinery one needs to frame theories and laws. They can do this not just with the elements of thought, but with more complex assemblies, allowing them to think in metaphors and analogies. Heat is a fluid. A message is a container. A society is a family. Obligations are bonds. The second stepladder of cognition is its combinatorial recursive power. The mind can entertain an explosive variety of ideas by assembling basic concepts like thing, place, path, actor, cause, and goal into propositions. And it can entertain not only propositions, but propositions about the propositions, and propositions about the propositions about the propositions. Bodies contain humors. Illness is an imbalance in the humors that bodies contain. I no longer believe the theory that illness is an imbalance in the humors that bodies contain. Thanks to language, ideas are not just abstracted and combined inside the head of a single thinker, but can be pooled across a community of thinkers. Thomas Jefferson explained the power of language with the help of an analogy. "He who receives an idea from me receives instruction himself without lessening mine, as he who lights his taper at mine receives light without darkening me." The potency of language as the original sharing app was multiplied by the invention of writing, and again in later epochs by the printing press, the spread of literacy, and electronic media. The networks of communicating thinkers expanded over time as populations grew, mixed, and became concentrated in cities. And the availability of energy beyond the minimum needed for survival gave more of them the luxury to think and talk. When large and connected communities take shape, they can come up with ways of organizing their affairs that work to their members' mutual advantage. Though everyone wants to be right, as soon as people start to air their incompatible views, it becomes clear that not everyone can be right about everything. Also, the desire to be right can collide with a second desire to know the truth, which is uppermost in the minds of bystanders to an argument who are not invested in which side wins. Communities can thereby come up with rules that allow true beliefs to emerge from the rough and tumble of argument, such as that you have to provide reasons for your beliefs, you're allowed to point out flaws in the beliefs of others, and you're not allowed to forcibly shut people up who disagree with you. Add in the rule that you should allow the world to show you whether your beliefs are true or false, and we can call the rules science. With the right rules, a community of less than fully rational thinkers can cultivate rational thoughts. The wisdom of crowds can also elevate our moral sentiments. When a wide enough circle of people confer on how best to treat each other, the conversation is bound to go in certain directions. If my starting offer is, "I get to rob, beat, enslave, and kill you and your kind, but you don't get to rob, beat, enslave, or kill me or my kind," I can't expect you to agree to the deal or third parties to ratify it, because there's no good reason that I should get privileges just because I'm me and you're not. Nor are we likely to agree to the deal. I get to rob, beat, enslave, and kill you and your kind, and you get to rob, beat, enslave, and kill me and my kind, despite its symmetry, because the advantages either of us might get in harming the other are massively outweighed by the disadvantages we would suffer in being harmed. Yet another implication of the law of entropy. Harms are easier to inflict and have larger effects than benefits. We'd be wiser to negotiate a social contract that puts us in a positive-sum game. Neither gets to harm the other, and both are encouraged to help the other. So for all the flaws in human nature, it contains the seeds of its own improvement, as long as it comes up with norms and institutions that channel parochial interests into universal benefits. Among those norms are free speech, nonviolence, cooperation, cosmopolitanism, human rights, and an acknowledgement of human fallibility. And among the institutions are science, education, media, democratic government, international organizations, and markets. Not coincidentally, these were the major brain children of the Enlightenment. Chapter 3. Counter-Enlightenments. Who could be against reason, science, humanism, or progress? The words seem saccharine, the ideals unexceptionable. They define the missions of all the institutions of modernity: schools, hospitals, charities, news agencies, democratic governments, international organizations. Do these ideals really need a defense? They absolutely do. Since the 1960s, trust in the institutions of modernity has sunk. And the second decade of the 21st century saw the rise of populist movements that blatantly repudiate the ideals of the Enlightenment. They are tribalist rather than cosmopolitan, authoritarian rather than democratic, contemptuous of experts rather than respectful of knowledge, and nostalgic for an idyllic past rather than hopeful for a better future. But these reactions are by no means confined to 21st century political populism, a movement we will examine in chapters 20 and 23. Far from sprouting from the grassroots or channeling the anger of know-nothings, the disdain for reason, science, humanism, and progress has a long pedigree in elite intellectual and artistic culture. Indeed, a common criticism of the Enlightenment project, that it is a Western invention, unsuited to the world in all its diversity, is doubly wrong-headed. For one thing, all ideas have to come from somewhere, and their birthplace has no bearing on their merit. The many Enlightenment ideas were articulated in their clearest and most influential form in 18th century Europe and America. They are rooted in reason and human nature, so any reasoning human can engage with them. That's why Enlightenment ideals have been articulated in non-Western civilizations at many times in history. But my main reaction to the claim that the Enlightenment is the guiding ideal of the West is, if only. The Enlightenment was swiftly followed by a counter-Enlightenment, and the West has been divided ever since. No sooner did people step into the light than they were advised that darkness wasn't so bad after all, that they should stop daring to understand so much, that dogmas and formulas deserved another chance, and that human nature's destiny was not progress, but decline. The Romantic movement pushed back particularly hard against Enlightenment ideals. Rousseau, Johann Herder, Friedrich Schelling, and others denied that reason could be separated from emotion, that individuals could be considered apart from their culture, that people should provide reasons for their acts, that values applied across times and places, and that peace and prosperity were desirable ends. A human is a part of an organic whole, a culture, race, nation, religion, spirit, or historical force, and people should creatively channel the transcendent unity of which they are a part. Heroic struggle, not the solving of problems, is the greatest good, and violence is inherent to nature and cannot be stifled without draining life of its vitality. There are but three groups worthy of respect, wrote Charles Baudelaire: the priest, the warrior, and the poet, to know, to kill, and to create. It sounds mad, but in the 21st century, those counter-enlightenment ideals continue to be found across a surprising range of elite cultural and intellectual movements. The notion that we should apply our collective reason to enhance flourishing and reduce suffering is considered crass, naive, wimpy, square. Let me introduce some of the popular alternatives to reason, science, humanism, and progress. They will reappear in other chapters, and in part three of the book, I will confront them head on. The most obvious is religious faith. To take something on faith means to believe it without good reason. So by definition, a faith in the existence of supernatural entities clashes with reason. Religions also commonly clash with humanism whenever they elevate some moral good above the well-being of humans, such as accepting a divine savior, ratifying a sacred narrative, enforcing rituals and taboos, proselytizing other people to do the same, and punishing or demonizing those who don't. Religions can also clash with humanism by valuing souls above lives, which is not as uplifting as it sounds. Belief in an afterlife implies that health and happiness are not such a big deal, because life on earth is an infinitesimal portion of one's existence, that coercing people into accepting salvation is doing them a favor, and that martyrdom may be the best thing that can ever happen to you. As for incompatibilities with science, these are the stuff of legend and current events, from Galileo and the Scopes monkey trial to stem cell research and climate change. A second counter-enlightenment idea is that people are the expendable cells of a superorganism, a clan, tribe, ethnic group, religion, race, class, or nation, and that the supreme good is the glory of this collectivity rather than the well-being of the people who make it up. An obvious example is nationalism, in which the superorganism is the nation-state, namely an ethnic group with a government. We see the clash between nationalism and humanism in morbid patriotic slogans like Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, sweet and right it is to die for your country, and happy those who with a glowing faith in one embrace clasped death in victory. Even John F. Kennedy's less gruesome, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, makes the tension clear. Nationalism should not be confused with civic values, public spirit, social responsibility, or cultural pride. Humans are a social species, and the well-being of every individual depends on patterns of cooperation and harmony that span a community. When a nation is conceived as a tacit social contract among people sharing a territory, like a condominium association, it is an essential means for advancing its members' flourishing. And of course it is genuinely admirable for one individual to sacrifice his or her interests for those of many individuals. It's quite another thing when a person is forced to make the supreme sacrifice for the benefit of a charismatic leader, a square of cloth, or colors on a map. Nor is it sweet and right to clasp death in order to prevent a province from seceding, expand a sphere of influence, or carry out an irredentist crusade. Religion and nationalism are signature causes of political conservatism and continue to affect the fate of billions of people in the countries under their influence. Many left-wing colleagues who learned that I was writing a book on reason and humanism egged me on, relishing the prospect of an arsenal of talking points against the right. But not so long ago, the left was sympathetic to nationalism when it was fused with Marxist liberation movements. And many on the left encourage identity politicians and social justice warriors who downplay individual rights in favor of equalizing the standing of races, classes, and genders, which they see as being pitted in zero-sum competition. Religion, too, has defenders on both halves of the political spectrum. Even writers who are unwilling to defend the literal content of religious beliefs may be fiercely defensive of religion and hostile to the idea that science and reason have anything to say about morality. Most of them show little awareness that humanism even exists. Defenders of the faith insist that religion has the exclusive franchise for questions about what matters, or that even if we sophisticated people don't need religion to be moral, the teeming masses do. Or that even if everyone would be better off without religious faith, it's pointless to talk about the place of religion in the world because religion is a part of human nature, which is why, mocking Enlightenment hopes, it is more tenacious than ever. In Chapter 23, I will examine all these claims. The left tends to be sympathetic to yet another movement that subordinates human interests to a transcendent entity, the ecosystem. The Romantic Green Movement sees the human capture of energy not as a way of resisting entropy and enhancing human flourishing, but as a heinous crime against nature, which will exact a dreadful justice in the form of resource wars, poisoned air and water, and civilization-ending climate change. Our only salvation is to repent, repudiate technology and economic growth, and revert to a simpler and more natural way of life. Of course, no informed person can deny that damage to natural systems from human activity has been harmful, and that if we do nothing about it, the damage could become catastrophic. The question is whether a complex, technologically advanced society is condemned to do nothing about it. In Chapter 10, we will explore a humanistic environmentalism more enlightened than romantic, sometimes called eco-modernism or eco-pragmatism. Left-wing and right-wing political ideologies have themselves become secular religions, providing people with a community of like-minded brethren, a catechism of sacred beliefs, a well-populated demonology, and a beatific confidence in the righteousness of their cause. In Chapter 21, we will see how political ideology undermines reason and science. It scrambles people's judgment, inflames a primitive tribal mindset, and distracts them from a sounder understanding of how to improve the world. Our greatest enemies are ultimately not our political adversaries, but entropy, evolution in the form of pestilence and the flaws in human nature, and most of all ignorance, a shortfall of knowledge of how best to solve our problems. The last two counter-enlightenment movements cut across the left-right divide. For almost two centuries, a diverse array of writers has proclaimed that modern civilization, far from enjoying progress, is in steady decline and on the verge of collapse. In The Idea of Decline in Western History, the historian Arthur Herman recounts two centuries of doomsayers who have sounded the alarm of racial, cultural, political, or ecological degeneration. Apparently, the world has been coming to an end for a long time indeed. One form of declinism bemoans our Promethean dabbling with technology. By wresting fire from the gods, we have only given our species the means to end its own existence, if not by poisoning our environment, then by loosing nuclear weapons, nanotechnology, cyber terror, bioterror, artificial intelligence, and other existential threats upon the world. Chapter 19. And even if our technological civilization manages to escape outright annihilation, it is spiraling into a dystopia of violence and injustice, a brave new world of terrorism, drones, sweatshops, gangs, trafficking, refugees, inequality, cyberbullying, sexual assault, and hate crimes. Another variety of declinism agonizes about the opposite problem. Not that modernity has made life too harsh and dangerous, but that it has made it too pleasant and safe. According to these critics, health, peace, and prosperity are bourgeois diversions from what truly matters in life. In serving up these Philistine pleasures, technological capitalism has only damned people to an atomized, conformist, consumerist, materialist, other-directed, rootless, routinized, soul-deadening wilderness. In this absurd existence, people suffer from alienation, angst, ennui, apathy, bad faith, ennui, malaise, and nausea. They are hollow men eating their naked lunches in the wasteland while waiting for Godot. I will examine these claims in chapters 17 and 18. In the twilight of a decadent, degenerate civilization, True liberation is to be found not in sterile rationality or effete humanism, but in an authentic, heroic, holistic, organic, sacred, vital being in itself and will to power. In case you are wondering what this sacred heroism consists of, Friedrich Nietzsche, who coined the term will to power, recommends the aristocratic violence of the blonde Teuton beasts and the samurai, Vikings, and Homeric heroes. Hard, cold, terrible, without feelings and without conscience, crushing everything and bespattering everything with blood. We'll take a closer look at this morality in the final chapter. Herman notes that the intellectuals and artists who foresee the collapse of civilization react to their prophecy in either of two ways. The historical pessimists dread the downfall but lament that we are powerless to stop it. The cultural pessimists welcome it with a ghoulish schadenfreude. Modernity is so bankrupt, they say, that it cannot be improved, only transcended. Out of the rubble of its collapse, a new order will emerge that can only be superior. A final alternative to Enlightenment humanism condemns its embrace of science. Following C.P. Snow, we can call it the second culture, the worldview of many literary intellectuals and cultural critics as distinguished from the first culture of science. Snow decried the Iron Curtain between the two cultures and called for a greater integration of science into intellectual life. It was not just that science was, in its intellectual depth, complexity, and articulation, the most beautiful and wonderful collective work of the mind of man. Knowledge of science, he argued, was a moral imperative, because it could alleviate suffering on a global scale by curing disease, feeding the hungry, saving the lives of infants and mothers, and allowing women to control their fertility. Though Snow's argument seems prescient today, a famous 1962 rebuttal from the literary critic F.R. Leavis was so vituperative that the Spectator had to ask Snow to promise not to sue for libel before they would publish it. After noting Snow's utter lack of intellectual distinction and embarrassing vulgarity of style, Leavis scoffed at a value system in which standard of living is the ultimate criterion. It's raising an ultimate aim. As an alternative, he suggested that, in coming to terms with great literature, we discover what at bottom we really believe. What for? What ultimately for? What do men live by? The questions work and tell at what I can only call a religious depth of thought and feeling. Anyone whose depth of thought and feeling extends to a woman in a poor country who has lived to see her newborn because her standard of living has risen, and then multiplied that sympathy by a few hundred million, might wonder why coming to terms with great literature is morally superior to raising the standard of living as a criterion for what at bottom we really believe, or why the two should be seen as alternatives in the first place. As we shall hear in Chapter 22, Leavis's outlook may be found in a wide swath of the second culture today. Many intellectuals and critics express a disdain for science as anything but a fix for mundane problems. They write as if the consumption of elite art is the ultimate moral good. Their methodology for seeking the truth consists not in framing hypotheses and citing evidence, but in issuing pronouncements that draw on their breadth of erudition and lifetime habits of reading. Intellectual magazines regularly denounce scientism, the intrusion of science into the territory of the humanities, such as politics and the arts. In many colleges and universities, science is presented not as the pursuit of true explanations, but as just another narrative or myth. Science is commonly blamed for racism, imperialism, world wars, and the Holocaust, and it is accused of robbing life of its enchantment and stripping humans of freedom and dignity. Enlightenment humanism, then, is far from being a crowd-pleaser. The idea that the ultimate good is to use knowledge to enhance human welfare leaves people cold. Deep explanations of the universe, the planet, life, the brain, unless they use magic, we don't want to believe them. Saving the lives of billions, eradicating disease, feeding the hungry, Boring. People extending their compassion to all of humankind, not good enough. We want the laws of physics to care about us. Longevity, health, understanding, beauty, freedom, love. There's got to be more to life than that. But it's the idea of progress that sticks most firmly in the craw. Even people who think it is a fine idea in theory to use knowledge to improve well-being insist it will never work in practice. And the Daily News offers plenty of support for their cynicism. The world is depicted as a veil of tears, a tale of woe, a slough of despond. Since any defense of reason, science, and humanism would count for nothing if, 250 years after the Enlightenment, we're no better off than our ancestors in the Dark Ages, an appraisal of human progress is where the case must begin. Part 2. Progress. If you had to choose a moment in history to be born, and you did not know ahead of time who you would be, you didn't know whether you were going to be born into a wealthy family or a poor family, what country you'd be born in, whether you were going to be a man or a woman. If you had to choose blindly what moment you'd want to be born, you'd choose now. Barack Obama, 2016. Chapter 4. Progressophobia. Intellectuals hate progress. Intellectuals who call themselves progressive really hate progress. It's not that they hate the fruits of progress, mind you. Most pundits, critics, and their bien-pensant readers use computers rather than quills and inkwells, and they prefer to have their surgery with anesthesia rather than without it. It's the idea of progress that rankles the chattering class. The Enlightenment belief that by understanding the world we can improve the human condition. An entire lexicon of abuse has grown up to express their scorn. If you think knowledge can help solve problems, then you have a blind faith and a quasi-religious belief in the outmoded superstition and false promise of the myth of the onward march of inevitable progress. You are a cheerleader for vulgar American can-doism, with the rah-rah spirit of boardroom ideology, Silicon Valley, and the Chamber of Commerce. You are a practitioner of Whig history, a naive optimist, a Pollyanna, and of course a Pangloss, a modern-day version of the philosopher in Voltaire's Candide, who asserts that all is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. Professor Pangloss, as it happens, is what we would now call a pessimist. A modern optimist believes that the world can be much, much better than it is today. Voltaire was satirizing not the Enlightenment hope for progress, but its opposite. The religious rationalization for suffering called theodicy, according to which God had no choice but to allow epidemics and massacres, because a world without them is metaphysically impossible. Epithets aside, the idea that the world is better than it was and can get better still fell out of fashion among the clerisy long ago. In The Idea of Decline in Western History, Arthur Herman shows that prophets of doom are the all-stars of the liberal arts curriculum, including Nietzsche, Arthur Schopenhauer, Martin Heidegger, Theodore Adorno, Walter Benjamin, Herbert Marcuse, Jean-Paul Sartre, Frantz Fanon, Michel Foucault, Edward Said, Cornel West, and a chorus of eco-pessimists. Surveying the intellectual landscape at the end of the 20th century, Herman lamented a grand recessional of the luminous exponents of Enlightenment humanism, the ones who believed that since people generate conflicts and problems in society, they can also resolve them. In History of the Idea of Progress, the sociologist Robert Nisbet agreed. The skepticism regarding Western progress that was once confined to a very small number of intellectuals in the 19th century has grown and spread to not merely the large majority of intellectuals in this final quarter of the century, but to many millions of other people in the West. Yes, it's not just those who intellectualize for a living who think the world is going to hell in a handcart. It's ordinary people, when they switch into intellectualizing mode. Psychologists have long known that people tend to see their own lives through rose-colored glasses. They think they're less likely than the average person to become the victim of a divorce, layoff, accident, illness, or crime. But change the question from the people's lives to their society, and they transform from Pollyanna to Eeyore. Public opinion researchers call it the optimism gap. For more than two decades, through good times and bad, when Europeans were asked by pollsters whether their own economic situation would get better or worse in the coming year, more of them said it would get better. But when they were asked about their country's economic situation, more of them said it would get worse. A large majority of Britons think that immigration, teen pregnancy, litter, unemployment, crime, vandalism, and drugs are a problem in the United Kingdom as a whole, while few think they are problems in their area. Environmental quality, too, is judged in most nations to be worse in the nation than in the community, and worse in the world than in the nation. In almost every year from 1992 through 2015, an era in which the rate of violent crime plummeted, a majority of Americans told pollsters that crime was rising. In late 2015, large majorities in 11 developed countries said that the world is getting worse, and in most of the last 40 years, a solid majority of Americans have said that the country is heading in the wrong direction. Are they right? Is pessimism correct? Could the state of the world, like the stripes on a barbershop pole, keep sinking lower and lower? It's easy to see why people feel that way. Every day the news is filled with stories about war, terrorism, crime, pollution, inequality, drug abuse, and oppression. And it's not just the headlines we're talking about, it's the op-eds and long-form stories as well. Magazine covers warn us of coming anarchies, plagues, epidemics, collapses, and so many crises, farm, health, retirement, welfare, energy, deficit, that copywriters have had to escalate to the redundant, serious crisis. Whether or not the world really is getting worse, the nature of news will interact with the nature of cognition to make us think that it is. News is about things that happen, not things that don't happen. We never see a journalist saying to the camera, "I'm reporting live from a country where a war has not broken out, or a city that has not been bombed, or a school that has not been shot up." As long as bad things have not vanished from the face of the earth, there will always be enough incidents to fill the news, especially when billions of smartphones turn most of the world's population into crime reporters and war correspondents. And among the things that do happen, the positive and negative ones unfold on different timelines. The news, far from being a first draft of history, is closer to play-by-play sports commentary. It focuses on discrete events, generally those that took place since the last edition. In earlier times, the day before, now seconds before. Bad things can happen quickly, but good things aren't built in a day, and as they unfold, they will be out of sync with the news cycle. The piece researcher John Galtung pointed out that if a newspaper came out once every 50 years, it would not report half a century of celebrity gossip and political scandals. It would report momentous global changes, such as the increase in life expectancy. The nature of news is likely to distort people's view of the world because of a mental bug that the psychologists Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman called the availability heuristic. People estimate the probability of an event or the frequency of a kind of thing by the ease with which instances come to mind. In many walks of life, this is a serviceable rule of thumb. Frequent events leave stronger memory traces, so stronger memories generally indicate more frequent events. You really are on solid ground in guessing that pigeons are more common in cities than orioles, even though you're drawing on your memory of encountering them rather than on a bird census. But whenever a memory turns up high in the result list of the mind's search engine for reasons other than frequency, because it is recent, vivid, gory, distinctive, or upsetting, people will overestimate how likely it is in the world. Which are more numerous in the English language? Words that begin with K, or words with K in the third position? Most people say the former. In fact, there are three times as many words with K in the third position. Ankle, ask, awkward, bake, cake, make, take. But we retrieve words by their initial sounds, so keep, kind, kill, kid, and king are likelier to pop into mind on demand. Availability errors are a common source of folly in human reasoning. First-year medical students interpret every rash as a symptom of an exotic disease, and vacationers stay out of the water after they have read about a shark attack or if they have just seen Jaws. Plane crashes always make the news, but car crashes, which kill far more people, almost never do. Not surprisingly, many people have a fear of flying, but almost no one has a fear of driving. People rank tornadoes, which kill about 50 Americans a year, as a more common cause of death than asthma, which kills more than 4,000 Americans a year, presumably because tornadoes make for better television. It's easy to see how the availability heuristic, stoked by the news policy, if it bleeds, it leads, could induce a sense of gloom about the state of the world. Media scholars who tally news stories of different kinds, or present editors with a menu of possible stories and see which they pick and how they display them, have confirmed that the gatekeepers prefer negative to positive coverage, holding the events constant. That, in turn, provides an easy formula for pessimists on the editorial page. Make a list of all the worst things that are happening anywhere on the planet that week, and you have an impressive-sounding case that civilization has never faced greater peril. The consequences of negative news are themselves negative. Far from being better informed, heavy news watchers can become miscalibrated. They worry more about crime, even when rates are falling. And sometimes they part company with reality altogether. A 2016 poll found that a large majority of Americans follow news about ISIS closely, and 77% agreed that Islamic militants operating in Syria and Iraq pose a serious threat to the existence or survival of the United States, a belief that is nothing short of delusional. Consumers of negative news, not surprisingly, become glum. A recent literature review cited misperception of risk, anxiety, lower mood levels, learned helplessness, contempt and hostility towards others, desensitization, and in some cases, complete avoidance of the news. And they become fatalistic, saying things like, "Why should I vote? It's not going to help," or, "I could donate money, but there's just going to be another kid who's starving next week." Seeing how journalistic habits and cognitive biases bring out the worst in each other, how can we soundly appraise the state of the world? The answer is to count. How many people are victims of violence as a proportion of the number of people alive? How many are sick? How many starving? How many poor? How many oppressed? How many illiterate? How many unhappy? And are those numbers going up or down? A quantitative mindset, despite its nerdy aura, is in fact the morally enlightened one, because it treats every human life as having equal value, rather than privileging the people who are closest to us or most photogenic. And it holds out the hope that we might identify the causes of suffering and thereby know which measures are most likely to reduce it. That was the goal of my 2011 book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, which presented 100 graphs and maps showing how violence and the conditions that foster it have declined over the course of history. To emphasize that the declines took place at different times and had different causes, I gave them names. The pacification process was a fivefold reduction in the rate of death from tribal raiding and feuding, the consequence of effective states exerting control over a territory. The civilizing process was a 40-fold reduction in homicide and other violent crimes, which followed upon the entrenchment of the rule of law and norms of self-control in early modern Europe. The humanitarian revolution is another name for the Enlightenment era abolition of slavery, religious persecution, and cruel punishments. The Long Peace is the historian's term for the decline of great power and interstate war after World War II. Following the end of the Cold War, the world has enjoyed a new peace with fewer civil wars, genocides, and autocracies. And since the 1950s, the world has been swept by a cascade of rights revolutions, civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, children's rights, and animal rights. Few of these declines are contested among experts who are familiar with the numbers. Historical criminologists, for example, agree that homicide plummeted after the Middle Ages, and it's a commonplace among international relations scholars that major wars tapered off after 1945. But they come as a surprise to most people in the wider world. I had thought that a parade of graphs with time on the horizontal axis, body counts or other measures of violence on the vertical, and a line that meandered from the top left to the bottom right, would cure audiences of the availability bias and persuade them that at least in this sphere of well-being, the world has made progress. But I learned from their questions and objections that resistance to the idea of progress runs deeper than statistical fallacies. Of course, any data set is an imperfect reflection of reality, so it is legitimate to question how accurate and representative the numbers truly are. But the objections revealed not just a skepticism about the data, but also an unpreparedness for the possibility that the human condition has improved. Many people lack the conceptual tools to ascertain whether progress has taken place or not. The very idea that things can get better just doesn't compute. Here are stylized versions of dialogues I have often had with questioners. So violence has declined linearly since the beginning of history. Awesome. No, not linearly. It would be astonishing if any measure of human behavior with all its vicissitudes ticked downward by a constant amount per unit of time, decade after decade and century after century. And not monotonically either, which is probably what the questioners have in mind. That would mean that it always decreased or stayed the same, never increased. Real historical curves have wiggles, upticks, spikes, and sometimes sickening lurches. Examples include the two world wars, a boom in crime in Western countries from the mid-1960s to the early 1990s, and a bulge of civil wars in the developing world following decolonization in the 1960s and 1970s. Progress consists of trends in violence on which these fluctuations are superimposed, a downward swoop or drift, a return from a temporary swelling to a low baseline. Progress cannot always be monotonic because solutions to problems create new problems. But progress can resume when the new problems are solved in their turn. By the way, the non-monotonicity of social data provides an easy formula for news outlets to accentuate the negative. If you ignore all the years in which an indicator of some problem declines and report every uptick, since, after all, it's news, readers will come away with the impression that life is getting worse and worse, even as it gets better and better. In the first 6 months of 2016, the New York Times pulled this trick three times, with figures for suicide, longevity, and automobile fatalities. Well, if levels of violence don't always go down, that means they're cyclical. So even if they're low right now, it's only a matter of time before they go back up. No, changes over time may be statistical, with unpredictable fluctuations, without being cyclical, namely oscillating like a pendulum between two extremes. That is, even if a reversal is possible at any time, that does not mean it becomes more likely as time passes. Many investors have lost their shirts betting on a misnamed business cycle that in fact consists of unpredictable swings. Progress can take place when the reversals in a positive trend become less frequent, become less severe, or in some cases, cease altogether. How can you say that violence has decreased? Didn't you read about the school shooting, or terrorist bombing, or artillery shelling, or soccer riot, or barroom stabbing in the news this morning? A decline is not the same thing as a disappearance. The statement, X is greater than Y, is different from the statement, Y equals zero. Something can decrease a lot without vanishing altogether. That means that the level of violence today is completely irrelevant to the question of whether violence has declined over the course of history. The only way to answer that question is to compare the level of violence now with the level of violence in the past. And whenever you look at the level of violence in the past, you find a lot of it, even if it isn't as fresh in memory as the morning's headlines. All your fancy statistics about violence going down don't mean anything if you're one of the victims. True, but they do mean that you're less likely to be a victim. For that reason, they mean the world to the millions of people who are not victims, but would have been if rates of violence had stayed the same. So you're saying that we can all sit back and relax, that violence will just take care of itself. Illogical, Captain. If you see that a pile of laundry has gone down, it does not mean the clothes washed themselves. It means someone washed the clothes. If a type of violence has gone down, then some change in the social, cultural, or material milieu has caused it to go down. If the conditions persist, violence could remain low or decline even further. If they don't, it won't. That makes it important to find out what the causes are, so we can try to intensify them and apply them more widely to ensure that the decline of violence continues. To say that violence has gone down is to be naive, sentimental, idealistic, romantic, starry-eyed, Whiggish, utopian, a Pollyanna, a pangloss. No. To look at data showing that violence has gone down and say violence has gone down is to describe a fact. To look at data showing that violence has gone down and say violence has gone up is to be delusional. To ignore data on violence and say violence has gone up is to be a know-nothing. As for accusations of romanticism, I can reply with some confidence. I am also the author of the staunchly unromantic, anti-utopian The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature, in which I argued that human beings are fitted by evolution with a number of destructive motives such as greed, lust, dominance, vengeance, and self-deception. But I believe that people are also fitted with a sense of sympathy, an ability to reflect on their predicament, and faculties to think up and share new ideas. The better angels of our nature, in the words of Abraham Lincoln. Only by looking at the facts can we tell to what extent our better angels have prevailed over our inner demons at a given time and place. How can you predict that violence will keep going down? Your theory could be refuted by a war breaking out tomorrow. A statement that some measure of violence has gone down is not a theory, but an observation of a fact. And, yes, the fact that a measure has changed over time is not the same as a prediction that it will continue to change in that way at all times forever. As the investment ads are required to say, past performance is no guarantee of future results. In that case, what good are all those graphs and analyses? Isn't a scientific theory supposed to make testable predictions? A scientific theory makes predictions in experiments in which the causal influences are controlled. No theory can make a prediction about the world at large with its 7 billion people spreading viral ideas in global networks and interacting with chaotic cycles of weather and resources. To declare what the future holds in an uncontrollable world and without an explanation of why events unfold as they do is not prediction but prophecy. And as David Deutsch observes, the most important of all limitations on knowledge creation is that we cannot prophesy. We cannot predict the content of ideas yet to be created or their effects. This limitation is not only consistent with the unlimited growth of knowledge, it is entailed by it. Our inability to prophesy is not, of course, a license to ignore the facts. An improvement in some measure of human well-being suggests that overall, more things have pushed in the right direction than in the wrong direction. Whether we should expect progress to continue depends on whether we know what those forces are and how long they will remain in place. That will vary from trend to trend. Some may turn out to be like Moore's Law. The number of transistors per computer chip doubles every 2 years, and give grounds for confidence, though not certainty, that the fruits of human ingenuity will accumulate and progress will continue. Some may be like the stock market and foretell short-term fluctuations but long-term gains. Some of these may reel in a statistical distribution with a thick tail, in which extreme events, even if less likely, cannot be ruled out. Still others may be cyclical or chaotic. In chapters 19